From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Those are the memorable final words of the 1974 movie of the same name, Chinatown, now considered a classic. Jack Nicholson's weary private eye is ennobled by his futile quest to untangle the scandal behind the wealth of Los Angeles. The movie was an unlikely success, a hodgepodge of insight, ambition, conflict, and more, born of titanic egos also including Robert Evans, Robert Towne, and Roman Polanski. No one quite knew why the pivotal mystery mattered. No one could agree whether Chinatown was a setting or a metaphor. Chinatown turned out to be a haunting rumination on the enduring presence of evil. The story of how Chinatown got made offers meditations on fame, on meaning, loss, and on moral culpability. Up next on Point, our conversation with the author Sam Wasson on the making of Chinatown. For listeners who are fans of the movie, what sticks with you about it? Why do you think it endures? We're at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With me right here in studio in New York City is Sam Wasson. He's a social historian who's written extensively about the figures who have helped to shape Hollywood. His new book is The Big Goodbye, Chinatown in the Last Years of Hollywood. You can find an excerpt of The Big Goodbye on our website, onpointradio.org. Sam Wasson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, that was so good. Thank you.
Well, it's, you know, words. I've got you in studio.
Well, we've got I agree with everything you said.
I'm down with that. This is why I invite guests on,
to agree with me only, ever,
and to affirm me. That's affirmation. Aside, let's talk about this movie, which is a classic, which I've seen a few times. Why this book now about this movie from almost a half century ago, which is really about a time, you know, 80 years ago in a moment in history in Los Angeles?
Well, it's as simple as the moment Trump won. I turned to my friend Graham, who I was watching it with, and after not being able to speak for a few minutes, I said to him, what's the movie? In other words, what's the precedent for this in American culture? Where can I look to get some kind of organization to my thinking? That's just how I think as a movie person, you know, what's the movie? And Chinatown popped into my brain. I mean, it was pretty automatic that this would be the next book that I would write for that reason.
So we're going to unpack the movie in a little bit, but why does this movie last? Why are we still talking about it? It was a bit of a risk.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant but jumbled mess of a script that first came in from Robert Towne.
Yeah.
Why does this movie endure?
Well, it's beautifully made on every level. This is just a beautiful production. The kind of big studio filmmaking that we just don't really have anymore for grown-ups. I mean, we have it for young people, which, you know, was in the theater every day. So that's one reason. But there were a lot of great movies made with this quality of production. What I think Chinatown has going for it is this metaphor for the American nightmare of, as Robert Towne described it, the futility of good intentions, hasn't been surpassed on film in terms of its darkness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what lodges inside people's hearts. And the metaphor itself is versatile enough to not just speak to the political condition, but also the metaphysical and the emotional. And for me, as a writer about Hollywood, it speaks to the condition of the Hollywood when this movie was made. I think Hollywood became Chinatown around 1974, 1975, which is to say a place where great work nearly stopped being regular.
All right. We're going to pick that up, and we're also going to pick up the question of Roman Polanski, his own tragic history,
mm-hmm.
how that informed what he did on screen, and also his own violent history and how that informs how we think about him
mm-hmm.
as a figure in Hollywood and outside of Hollywood. But first, I want to talk about the thematic elements
mm-hmm.
that you raised. You talked about it, about the futility of good intentions, I think. It struck me in reading your book and thinking about this film through the prism of what I read in your book that there's another element there as well, the question of darkness that you cite. You know, director Polanski drew on his own dark understanding of life to make this film and to sort of shape and reshape its ending. He was a child in the Holocaust in Poland, his pregnant mother taken and killed by Nazis. Then his pregnant wife, the actor Sharon Tate, was herself killed as part of the Manson murders in Los Angeles. Polanski spoke with the American Film Institute in 2009.
You have to show the results of evil. That's how the tragedies in Greek theaters were conceived, you know. If everything ends up in a happy way, at the end, you forget the film of a dinner.
Polanski has also said, I thought it was a serious movie, not an adventure story for kids. Beautiful blondes die in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Sharon had. Mm-hmm. This movie played out, was conceived and created after her death. Mm-hmm. What was the thread of evil that went through this film? You know, we can talk a little bit about the surprise at the end, which is probably not a surprise for those who know the film. But in terms of the great secrets of Los Angeles, in terms of what inspired Robert Towne to think about how power played out in L.A.
Well, after the murders, Towne, who was an L.A. native, really experienced the overnight change to the city. LA went from being, you know, a sort of a friendly our town to being a Chinatown, and
explain what you mean by that.
Which part?
About a Chinatown.
Well, you know, after when you wake up and read in the papers that that Hollywood's princess Sharon Tate and her friends have been brutally murdered. I mean, grotesquely and enigmatically murdered. The feeling is, well, anything can happen. I mean, it plunges the city into a sense of nihilism.
It goes from something in your book, it's like carefree and it's fun and it's free love and there's drugs and whatever. And then suddenly, like, it's people are using this stuff for escape and just self-indulgence. They can't handle it.
They can't handle it. And it really can't be overdetermined how abrupt the change to Los Angeles was. So Towne, being a native, was then naturally inclined to some kind of nostalgia and look back and say, well, what happened to this city? What happened to the L.A. that I grew up in? What happened to the city that I loved? And in the course of his research, he read Cary McWilliams' book, An Island on the – oh, God, now I'm embarrassed. I forgot it. An Island on the Land, which is one of the most beautiful books about L.A. ever written. And in this book, Williams talks about the Owens Valley Water Wars, which was a very real scandal, and is laid out quite clearly in Chinatown. And that became the basis for this script, which is a slightly fictionalized version of what really happened in the city.
Basically, L.A., you know, is beautiful, set draped essentially over what is mostly arid or desert land.
Yes.
Water diverted.
Yes.
Artificial shortages created.
Yes.
And fortunes made.
Exactly. Exactly. So the city is a crime. The whole city is a crime. And to this day, still is. And that became really, I mean, one way to elevate this movie above the conventions of detective genre. And to go back to your first question, why do we keep going back to this movie, it's got more going on than just a detective story. You know, for all Raymond Chandler's great style, you could make an argument that these books aren't really about anything. I wouldn't make that argument, but smart people have made that argument. It's undeniable that Chinatown has something enormous on its mind.
You're an LA guy. I'm from Southern California. I'm from Orange County. But this I didn't take Chinatown as history when I first saw it, but I took it as, you know, it just was awe-striking in terms of what I learned about the city as well as the cinematic thing there. What did you learn about L.A. As a L.A. guy yourself, as a guy steeped in Hollywood? What did you learn about L.A. as a result of doing this
Well,
book?
I've always been fascinated by this question of why we're the noir city. And this book really became an excuse for me to indulge that fascination that I had. Why is it that this
Raymond Chandler.
Yes.
Why Sam Spade, Philip Marlowe,
right,
all that stuff.
You know, why do we have this dark side? Is it real? Or is this really just something that the East Coast has foisted upon us? You know, the snobbery of the East Coast intellect. And to a certain extent, that's a part of it. But really, it originated, I found in the course of my research, with the fact that L.A. was sold to the rest of the country as the Sunshine State, a Sunshine City. And as a result of this enormous population boom that the city really couldn't accommodate, collapsed. briefly under the pressure of all of this influx. And so then noir became the shadow to the sunshine, and people came to see, oh, wait a second, there is an underside to this dream. So that really is the basis for noir as I think I understand it.
It's surprising to me. You know, your book comes out, obviously you've been in the work for years, so many interviews, so many documents you went into. Tarantino evokes some of the same period, right, in terms of the period in the creation of this film in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, he starts before I do. I mean, I go, you know, he's about the murders, and I start with the murders. I guess he ends with the murders. It was a joy to see L.A. recreated in that movie. I could have watched it a long, long time, but I'm not really objective about it because I'm such a fan of that moment and that milieu, obviously.
What do you think – where do we end up in that movie in our understanding of what's possible versus where we start?
What, Quentin's movie or Chinatown?
No, Chinatown itself.
Well, I think the movie ends – I mean, it's as grim as could possibly be. I mean, nothing is really possible by the end of the movie. It's an Oedipus story in the sense of all you can really say for its happy ending is that we see the truth finally, and it's ugly. Our delusions are shattered.
And yet there had been a fight over the question of hope, that Robert Towne wanted a bit of hope, and Polanski said absolutely not.
Yeah. Towne wanted a sort of a bittersweet ending, and I wouldn't even say bittersweet, but like you said, an ending with a glimmer of hope where the bad guys don't totally get away. And Roman, as we heard, said, no, you got to shatter them.
We're discussing the classic 1974 film Chinatown, its meaning, its legacy, and its backstory. We're listening right now to The Way You Look Tonight. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about a new book that goes behind the scenes of the making of the memorable 1974 film Chinatown and why the movie stands the test of time. With me in studio is author Sam Wasson. His new book is The Big Goodbye, Chinatown in the Last Years of Hollywood. You can hear Sam Wasson in your very title. It sort of evokes a Chandlerian title, right? Mm. It sounds like it, Private Eye. And that is what the story is built around, is this private eye thinking he's involved in an adultery case and getting drawn into some of the power plays and murderous schemes behind the great fortunes of Los Angeles. Jack Nicholson plays Jake Gittes. Polanski has a bit part. He's the director. He's a big part as a thug. Faye Dunaway plays Evelyn Mulray, her links to the tycoon. Noah Cross, played by the director John Huston, are unclear and become untangled only toward the very end. This was, in some ways, if you really were to plot this on a wall, you'd go slightly mad. I mean, this is a Byzantine and twisty, you know, labyrinth of a plot, you know, where you just feel like you're spinning tops and hoping to keep up, right? The actor turned Hollywood producer Robert Evans was the head of Paramount Pictures at the time. He was the near singular force behind getting Chinatown greenlit for production from his bosses. Here he spoke on PBS in 2002.
First of all, no one wanted to make it. But distribution read it, they thought it was in Chinese. When the picture was finished, they didn't know what to do with it. They said, no one will understand it. No one understood it until it opened. And it's strange, everybody understood it.
Other movies associated with Evans include Love Story, Rosemary's Baby, which itself was also directed by Roman Polanski, The Godfather, that which preceded Godfather II, made the same year as Chinatown, Serpico, and Harold Maud. He had quite a run there. Why did Robert Evans, whom you interviewed for this book, why did he believe in this? Why did he want to get it made?
That's the central question. I mean, for me at least, one of the central questions. He didn't believe in it. He believed in the people who were making it. The script, as you said, was absolutely baffling to him. You know, the first draft came in at around 350 pages. It was really, really tough reading. But Robert Evans knew he had a Robert Towne screenplay, and that was enough for him. Combined with Jack Nicholson, combined with Roman Polanski, he bet on talent the way that many Hollywood producers today bet on IP. You know, they'll bet on the Star Wars of it all or the Harry Potter of it all.
Marvel
of it all. Exactly. Well, before that existed, all you really had, you know, in the before sequels was great artists. And so Evan said, yeah, I don't know what this means, but I know you're good for this. So let's go with your instincts. And really great producing is as simple as that. I asked Evans when I was interviewing him, I said, you know, this sounds really, I don't want to say easy. He said, it is easy. You bet on the talent. And that was it.
He was something that had the looks of a marquee star himself.
Yes.
It seemed as though you're capturing this period in Hollywood in which he gets up ahead of steam, is able to make some movies that people actually admire and want to watch, and suddenly this is what Hollywood is about for a stretch. Mm-hmm. What was it, 5-7 years?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, late 68 to 74, 75, I would think of as the golden period, which really is represent the Evans years. Evan came to the head of Paramount 68, 69, and left right after Chinatown.
So, you know, 74, we had an author on earlier last year who argued 99 might be the greatest year in film. Okay. 74, if you just take Godfather 2 and Chinatown and The Conversation, which is a blow-me-away film, that seems to just an extraordinary explosion.
Yeah, also Lenny is in there. I mean, yes. I mean, no one can really say what the greatest – it's kind of a silly thing to –
Absolutely.
You know.
But the real question is why did that – why did grown-up films proliferate at that time? You know, even a more frivolous one like The Sting is terrifically made. You know, why are films like that being made there, and why did it suddenly – why did it pop?
There was an influx of corporate money from folks like Charlie Bluedorn at Gulf and Western who bought Paramount. So that was the first good thing. Now, that could have gone bad if Charlie meddled in the work of Evans, but he didn't. He said, here's the money. Go do what you do. And then Evans, in turn, took that money and he hired the artists to go do what they did. For the same reason you wouldn't commission Picasso and then say, Pablo, could you put a little more blue in the corner of the frame here? That's how Evans worked. Now, it stopped working that way once executives realized that they could engineer a hit. And that happened around the time of Exorcist, Jaws. Jaws was really the famous breakthrough when that happened, which is 1975. The same year, by the way, that CAA congealed, ICM congealed, and Robert Evans left Paramount. So you have a perfect storm that incites the executives to say, we know how to do this better than the artists. And then it was over.
I want to incorporate a couple of notes from listeners from online, from our website. A listener who posts this, Hammerman says, great, maybe my favorite movie, Nicholson's best performance, tremendous writing, story, dialogue, the backstory of the great L.A. water theft and wicked surprise ending. Can't recommend it enough to those who haven't seen it. Forget the latest superhero franchise. And then writes, when I lived in L.A., I went to climb Mount Whitney. Enraged that ranchers were still blowing up water pipelines, sending their precious bodily fluid south into the desert city. Another listener on Twitter posts, Reef Cohen writes, interesting that the same subject of water wars with the theme of season 3 of Goliath, is this still something that goes on? Are the fights of water still raging in Los Angeles and points north?
I don't know. My research ended around 1978. It wouldn't surprise me. And whether it's happening or not, corruption of this kind is happening. You know, obviously, I don't need to – we all know it's happening.
And there certainly are public policy fights over water in the Western states, for real. I wanted to talk a little bit – you mentioned Robert Evans didn't interfere like didn't want, you know, he might have suggestions.
He did interfere, I should say. I mean, he did interfere sometimes to his detriment. He did interfere, but he, for the most part, would back off. A guy like, producer like John Callie was famous for not interfering, a great producer, the head of Warner Brothers around the same time. But I'm so glad you brought that up. Evans sometimes got too carried away, but with his own influence. But finally, he knew that there was a boundary there.
And yet each of the four men that you focus on, Robert Evans, Robert Towne, the scriptwriter, Jack Nicholson, the star, Roman Polanski, the director, each of them brought things to this script, to this story, to this conceit. And, you know, Evans may not have been right in the scrum, but there was a tussle in terms of what happened. Robert Towne ultimately wasn't able to bring it home, it seems to me, from your accounting. Like, he did so more than he did in subsequent projects, but that, you know, he couldn't quite realize this. And it was a point where he had worked so hard to retain control over this project, and he realized he needed to yield to allow the director to make it his own.
Yeah, which is the story of the screenwriter, you know? I mean, that is its own kind of Chinatown, you know? Those were the futility of Towns's good intentions. He wanted to direct this thing. But the way that it goes so often in Hollywood is that if you need the money, and in Towne's case, he did, he had to sell the rights to the script that he wanted to retain. And so he literally sold out, had to. And Evans bought it and hired Roman. And from that point on, it was Evans was really the boss, and turned the reins over to Roman. And so Roman won. I think I'm thankful that Roman won, because I think his ending is the right one. Roman won those screenwriting battles with Towne that have been written about before, very famously.
Let's play for listeners a scene from the movie itself. During their final confrontation at the Mulray Mansion, Jake Gittes, the private eye, demands answers from this tycoon who's at the center of this scandal. That's Noah Cross, played, as I said earlier, by the director John Huston. Why hurt, Gittes is effectively asking, so many people simply to pile fortune upon fortune?
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gittes. The future. Now, where's the girl? I want the only daughter I've got left. You found out Evelyn was lost to me a long time ago.
Who do you blame for that, her?
I don't blame myself. See, Mr. Gittes, most people never have to face the fact that at the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
The tycoon taking many privileges, including the right to mispronounce Gittes' name again. Did that reveal a truth to the filmmakers, or did that feel true to a mood they wanted to evoke?
Both. Mm-hmm. Absolutely both. I mean, and it's a metaphysical question that most of us thankfully don't have the answer to. Most of us have never been in that situation, and I hope most of us never are in that situation. But we're seeing it played out right now in Washington. And that's why I think the movie is more relevant now than it even was then, in the midst of Watergate and Vietnam.
Why?
Well, because we're seeing a level of evil and depravity that we've never seen before, frankly, in this country. And Robert Towne and his team, that included Evans and Polanski, think that they at that point it really was the worst thing that they had ever seen, what was going on in terms of the futility of good intentions around Vietnam and Watergate. But now, I mean, I can't even comment. You know, it's we don't know the bottom of evil. When we think we've hit the bottom of evil, how can we know that there isn't a bottom under that bottom waiting to emerge?
And you mentioned that you thought that they were responding to the Manson murders and how that shaped LA. But you're saying they're also responding to the moment of sort of existential crisis in the country. Who are we as a country? Vietnam, you know, the assassinations, Watergate, political crisis.
Yes, and in our own lives, you know, when we see something horrible, we might say at that moment, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. That's the worst thing I've ever felt. And then 2 years later, 5 years later, something worse happens.
I'd like to take a call now from Hornell, New York. Steve, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
I just wanted to say that in my opinion, it was a golden age of Bob films, because beyond the films that you mentioned, there was also Last Picture Show, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Brewster McCloud. There were just a lot of great films, Night Moves, a lot of great films. I feel that, like Roger Ebert said, it was a golden era of film. And I know that you're the panelist that you have on the show, I know he said that you can't really say one way or another what's a good year and what good period and what is a bad period. But I don't know. There's nothing compared to today that's the same as it was at that time, except for maybe some shows on TV mm-hmm. that are well written and compelling, like those films were.
Thanks for that, Steve. So what about that, Sam Wasson? We've a caller there, Steve, who's talking about a time where movies were made, I think, effectively, he's saying, for grown-ups, that they aren't fairy tales. They're not going to land perfectly. All the loose ends are not going to be tied up. Is it harder to make those films now?
Yes.
Even with all the different opportunities and different yes. producers and billions of dollars yes. being slathered on by Netflix and yes. Amazon and the rest?
Yes. And a point I'd like to bring up is that these are films in the sense that they use images and sound to convey poetically what can't be said in words. I mean, these are movies. They are not, in other words, television, whose primary vehicle of expression is verbal. And I think right now, I believe right now, the line between film and television has muddied to such a degree that we're not really keeping the distinction between them, which is imperiling this art form of cinema. In the 70s, that wasn't the case. The line between the two was very well drawn, and audiences understood that. The films the gentleman just mentioned, the Altman movies, those are movies. Those are using sound, in Altman's case, sound so voluminously to convey a whole host of things, you know, namely the craziness of American culture. You hear that craziness in an Altman movie. You hear it. It's not in the language so much as the way the language just loads up our heads, one speaker after the next. That's movie making. That's not television.
I'll take a call now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Robert, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going? I just had a question on the prequel to Chinatown in development by Robert Towne, and if you knew anything about that, what real direction or substance he's going to go with, and whether or not that will sort of get into the tensions you described between Polanski and Towne during the original Chinatown.
I only know what's written about it online, which is to say probably as much as you or the listeners. But what's interesting to me is that Towne and Polanski fought about Nicholson's backstory, which I presume will form the basis for the prequel, and whether or not they should show in detail what happened to Nicholson's character.
Towne, meaning how he got to the,
how
who he was.
Yes, exactly. Well, what happened in Chinatown before the events of the movie began. Towne, who did so much preparation, had all of this information. He wanted to go through Nicholson's backstory. Roman Polanski said, if we're too specific about this, we're going to lose the metaphoric impact of just suggesting it. And Roman won. And all of that is to say, I'm dubious if you do make a movie that goes into the backstory, it could tamper with the power of the metaphor, which needs to be kept vague and emotional.
And briefly, thanks for that call, Robert. Briefly, before this little segment break, there's a little anecdote you tell about what Towne, or what I think one of his friends, heard from a cop who had been in Chinatown that sort of inspired the line and inspired the thinking a little bit.
Yeah. Towne was with a wonderful woman named Julie Payne, and right after the Manson murders, Julie was so freaked out. They lived one canyon over from Benedict. They lived right off Benedict, which is where the murders happened. So Julie was so scared she wanted a gun. And Towne had a vice cop named Tony Silas come up to the house and to consult on giving Julie a gun. And in the course of their just chit-chat, he learned that the cop had been in Chinatown, and Towne said to him, "So what goes on in Chinatown?" And he says, "Well, we're just advised to stay out of Chinatown." And Towne said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, there's so many languages, there's so much cultural confusion, nothing that we can penetrate, so, you know, just basically
we don't know what happens.
We don't know. Yeah, get out, stay out, yeah."
Forget it. It's Chinatown. We're discussing everything you'll ever need to know about the iconic movie Chinatown, its pivotal place in the history of Hollywood. You can share your take on the important takeaways from the film, which scenes resonate with you. We're out on Twitter and on Facebook at onpointradio.org. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about the movie Chinatown with a foremost authority on Hollywood. With me here in studio in New York City is author Sam Wasson. His new book is The Big Goodbye, Chinatown and the Last Years of Hollywood. We're hearing from listeners online. We're getting some calls, two of which I'll take in a moment. Lee Rollins writes on Facebook, Chinatown feels timeless. It's a compelling case that the alleged simplest of endeavors can prove to be wholly fruitless. It's ultimately a story about ignorance. People don't know what they actually don't want to know. Holly Forsman writes on Twitter, the executives thought they could engineer hits. Bingo. That resonates throughout our culture, giving us Cats. Thank you, Sam Wasson. Film lovers have long wondered what ended the period of movie masterpieces. We can now only see him on TCM, and that if we're lucky. I want to take a call now from Brooklyn, Maine. Judy, thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in today.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You had asked why Chinatown is so wonderful, and I wanted to say that I think it's such an amazing movie because it takes the best of Raymond Chandler, which was his atmospherics, and it weds it to a really good spot. I don't know if this is a true story, but I've always heard that when one of the Raymond Chandler movies was being filmed, the director, maybe it was Billy Wilder, had to call up Raymond Chandler and say, we all are wondering why the chauffeur got bumped off. And Raymond Chandler said, I'll call you back in 10 minutes. And he called back and said, you know what? I don't know why I had the chauffeur bumped off. So his plots didn't always hold together. But Chinatown takes all the thinking that Chandler did about L.A. and all the slumming angels and just put it to a blockbuster plot, and I think that Robert Cohen is a genius.
Thanks for that, Judy. Sam Wasson?
Yes, you said it better than I could. It took the atmospherics of Chandler and set them on an important plot. And the movie that you're referring to is The Big Sleep, and the director's Howard Hawks, and the screenwriter was incredibly William Faulkner. And yes, that's a true story, or at least a true legend, one that I've heard before.
It's amazing. Thanks for that, Judy. We also have a comment from someone who posted on our website going by, I'm pretty sure, a pseudonym, Gerald F. Nord. In The Third Man, our listener writes, Harry Lime gets it wrong. Cuckoo clocks were developed in Bavaria, not Switzerland, as he claims. But his basic point comparing the art that came out of corrupt, violent, vice-ridden Renaissance Italy and from peaceful, rational, well, post-Calvinist dictatorship of Geneva, the orderly Switzerland, is a good one. And then the listener writes, this doesn't excuse or suggest we encourage sick minds and evil behavior for art's sake, but it does suggest that we not be surprised when great art has doubtful origins. Let's talk about one of the key players in here. You interviewed Roman Polanski, and it clearly helped inform your understanding, your reflection of what he did. You talked as he has done a bit, and as he's portrayed on film a little bit about his haunting childhood. His movie, The Pianist, I think is a masterpiece about being a child in the Holocaust, in his case in Poland during Nazi occupation and oppression there, and the loss of his mother and other family members, friends and neighbors. You talk about the loss of Sharon Tate. You also write about the rape he did. This is upsetting stuff, folks. So I want to be clear that. But he had sex with a 13-year-old. It is statutory rape, and it is rape, clearly. He was convicted in this country and then fled. Interestingly, I hadn't understood all of the backstory. It appears that both defense and prosecutors felt that the judge had wanted to seem tough and had embarked on a corrupt sentencing, effectively. That is, that he would make it seem a lot tougher than what Polanski would actually do, but that there were no guarantees, and he fled the country. And he has not come back. He remains in Europe. What Polanski did is monstrous. It happened after the death of his wife. It happened after the trauma he went through in the Holocaust. But it can't excuse what he did. And he seems, in other quotes that you have, at one point he writes, or he says, I guess, in a quote, he says, you write that Polanski confessed to sleeping with Swiss girls as young as 16 at one point. And then he said that's the actual age of consent in Switzerland. And then Polanski said they're more beautiful than they would ever be again. Mm. He wrote that in his memoir, as you recount it. It seems as though Polanski kind of gives himself a pass on this. How are we to evaluate somebody who is so masterful as a director and is at least this one time at minimum, done something so vile and offensive as to shock the conscience?
I think you just evaluated him perfectly. I mean, he's all those things. All those things are true. And to deny the existence of any one of them, whether it's the fact that he raped a 13-year-old girl or that he made The Pianist, is to not see reality. So I think it's actually rather not a complex question. He's a complex figure. But the answer to that question of how we evaluate him is we hold all of these things as true because they are.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, he raped a girl, an underage girl, and he is also the greatest living filmmaker, arguably. And both are true. How does that change? One doesn't change the existence of the other.
He has not been as prolific as he was in that stretch before this trial, before those charges. At the same time, Hollywood has still made movies with him. Major studios have still done that. Is that appropriate?
Yes, because he's a great artist.
It's complicated. I mean, we've seen that with Kobe Bryant. We've seen that with the Me Too moment. We've seen it with Harvey Weinstein on trial right now in New York, here in New York City, not so many blocks from where we're talking. I don't think too many people would be open to be making movies with Harvey Weinstein, although he was one of the most impressive and productive and artistically – you know, he fostered some really incredible films.
Yeah.
But Hollywood has turned its back on Harvey Weinstein.
Yes. Yes, they have. Yes, they have. Yeah. He seems to be a real monster, and he was also capable of bringing some terrific film to Americans. Both are true.
How was he as an interview?
Polanski?
Yeah.
He answered every question that I had. He was gregarious and intelligent and reflective. I enjoyed my time speaking with him. I did not approach these – I did not ask him these hard questions. He's been on the record about it before, and I wanted to ask him stuff about the film that he really hadn't spoken about and the era that he worked in to sort of shade in information that I didn't have. I enjoyed my time speaking with him.
We want to take a call now from Janet. She's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Thanks for listening, Janet.
Hi. I'm very interested to hear where you are in the conversation. This is just one woman's experience, but I was maybe 13, 14, I think, when I saw Chinatown, when it first came out. And at that time, I shared a pedophile with my mother in the person of her father. And whether or not films, you know, need to be made by people like Polanski. I honestly, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I am an artist myself, and you know, you make art for all kinds of reasons. But I can certainly say that when I saw the moment, what we still refer to as that difficult, confronting moment mm-hmm. at the very end with Faye Dunaway, mm-hmm. for a very few of us, that was an affirmation of reality that has stayed with me my whole life. I felt like someone understands.
Janet, maybe if you stay on the line with us for a moment, I'll play that clip for listeners, okay? If that won't be too upsetting.
No. Like I said, it's not upsetting to me because I don't have to imagine it. I can testify to it.
So this is a pivotal scene that Janet's alluding to. It's so classic that in the years since it's been parodied many times, but it is upsetting and it is riveting. It comes toward the end of the film. Jack Nicholson as the private eye Jake Geddes is trying to understand the hold that a major Los Angeles tycoon has over Evelyn Mulray, and also the hold that the tycoon has over the tycoon's mistress. Mulray is played by Faye Dunaway. Here's a portion of that memorable scene.
Who is she? And don't give me that crap about your sister because you don't have a sister.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine.
Catherine who?
She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister and my daughter.
Janet, that scene there, I think, is what you were referring to. And you're saying, as upsetting as that was on a number of levels, including that J.J. Geddes is slapping Faye Dunaway's character brutally, that made you feel human.
Isn't that extraordinary? Yes, that is what I'm saying. So, let's see. Yeah, I think the fact that we are having this conversation now in public for everyone to hear is of enormous value. And I hope more difficult and confronting films will be made. I don't expect them to be made in my lifetime, even though I have a long way to go. And I have a very good life now.
Thank you for sharing your story for that, Janet. I appreciate it so much. So Sam Wasson, I see you sort of thunderstruck a little bit from listening to what Janet had to say. In terms of the theme and the reveal of incest being a central secondary corruption in this film, there are two things that strike me, one of which is, my God, that must have been a fight to get that in there, given sort of executive sensibility. And the second, you know, is this, like Chinatown itself, a metaphor? Or is there a reason why that was something they specifically wanted in the film?
Well, the idea is that he raped the land and he raped his daughter. And this is what evil does. Takes and takes and takes and takes and takes. I'm so moved by what Janet said. This is what art is for, right? To make us feel less alone in our suffering. I'm amazed. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people who love Chinatown, and I've never heard anything like that. So I'm really just thank you, Janet.
Yeah, appreciative for our listeners. Appreciative for Janet, for sure. This was a film that they tried to make a sequel for in 1990. I think I took a bus, or I drove my buddy Robert at the time to go see The Two Jakes in an Orange County Edwards cinema. And I wanted to see it. It was a beautiful palette. I remember that. Harvey Keitel joined the cast. I remember that. Didn't quite work.
Mm-mm.
It struck me, they talked about a trilogy. It struck me that in some ways the real trilogy, maybe I'm wrong, correct me, but in real, the trilogy would be Chinatown, Roger Rabbit, about the destruction of the yes. mass transit,
yes.
you know, in L.A. And then L.A. Confidential, about how L.A. itself is kind of corrupted by power and Hollywood and fame. Mm. Do those scan, or is there something incomplete about what town and what the others had hoped to do?
Well, the idea of I love what you said. I mean that, yes. And Roger Rabbit makes some very conscious allusions to Chinatown.
Sure.
Such a fun movie and worth going back and seeing. Just wildly imaginative and fabulous movie. The idea behind the Chinatown trilogy, two of which were made, was that the first one would be about the water scandal. The second one would be about the land scandal. And the third one – real estate, yes, and oil. And the third one would be about the air. In other words, smog and traffic. Huh. That one never got made, obviously. So that was the conceptual organizing force. And one would be the 30s, one would be the 40s, and one would be the 50s. And Jake would age in parallel with Jack.
Boyhood. The actor kind of.
Exactly. Huh. It would be an evil Boyhood is exactly what it would be. And unfortunately, we only have two out of the three.
And why didn't that one work, the two J's?
Well, part of the problem is it was not organized by a studio the way Chinatown was. This is a really studio movie. And when the studio started to disintegrate, the ability for Evans to control the elements of the movie also started to considerate. Disintegrate. Not to mention the fact that there was now a lot of drugs in Hollywood. Evans was addled. Town was addled. Polanski was obviously a fugitive, couldn't come back. And Jack did his absolute best to try to keep this together, and it was too much for him to handle.
The one Jack trying to manage the two Jakes. That's the last word from Sam Wasson. He's author of The Big Goodbye, Chinatown in the Last Years of Hollywood. Sam, great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point's produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amata, Brittany Knotts, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim, with help from Carolyn Love and Bradley Noble. This is the love theme from the movie, the end title of the film. You've been listening to us here at our studios in New York. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.